Hi there, I'm Ken Cruz, author of Dad Bod, and you're listening to Pop Goes Your World.
If you haven't already, subscribe on iTunes. And while you're there, please leave us a rating and review.
And now, it's time for our featured presentation.
I'm Chris McBrien, and the pop culture from Generation X is everything to me.
And I'm Derek Myers, and I'm here to educate Chris on the great pop culture of today's generation.
Episode 287, Night Shift Movie Review. Chris McBrien, along with Derek Myers, and this is Pop Goes Your World, the pop culture podcast for the generations. This week, I wanted to go back to 1982 and review the Ron Howard-directed comedy Night Shift, starring my hero, Henry Winkler. But before we get into our movie this week, what is new in the world of pop culture for you, Derek?
Hey, Chris.
Hi.
I actually have two things. Sorry, I know you before the show. I told you I was going to have one thing. I have two things this week. Okay. One brand new that we saw in the theater and one documentary.
Oh, cool.
So I'm going to start with the brand new thing. My wife and I had a chance to go out and see the brand new film Civil War. Not to be confused with Captain America Civil War that came out a decade ago. This is the one that is basically the premise is the U.S. has fallen apart. It has fallen into civil war. And this is what's happening. The movie,
like, it takes place back in the American Civil War.
No, it takes place like 5 years from now. Like, what happens if things fall apart in the U.S.?
Okay, they already have. Sorry.
Well, I think that's part of this political and social commentary of the movie. So I'll start by saying I really liked it. It was absolutely not what I was expecting, and so it took me sort of a little while into the movie to sort of grapple with, like, well, where's this going? What is this actually showing me? What's this movie really about? And by the end of it, though, I really liked where it ended up going. Whereas my wife really disliked it because she said, like, the trailer sold me a different, well, not that she had even seen the trailer, but just based on the little bit of blurb she thought she was getting into, she's like, it didn't give me what I was expecting, and what it gave me was not fulfilling. Again, I don't want to spoil too much because I think a lot of people are interested in this movie. But I will just say the trailers make it look a lot more actiony than it is. The sort of high level spoiler free premise is that this civil war has happened, and this movie basically is covering the last days of this civil war as some sort of resolution is happening. I think many people were expecting to see this movie where you get to see how and why this happened. The people who made this movie basically said, we're not getting into that. All you have to believe coming into this movie is that stuff has happened and this is where we are now. And they literally spend no time exploring the hows and whys of how we got here. It's more of what's happening now post Civil War. And I think if more people knew that, that it might bring a certain audience to the theater that might not have otherwise gone. And I think some people who are rushing out to see it that have a certain expectation might give it a second thought. But overall, I really liked it. Again, I don't want to say too much about it just because there's a lot of stuff that it's very spoilery. So I don't really want to go down that road too much. But I definitely enjoyed it a lot. So that one's called Civil War. It's in theaters now.
Okay.
And then I had a chance to watch a documentary.
For 40 days and 40 nights, he watches documentaries. He likes to learn about the world. It's Derek's Documentaries. Derek's Documentaries.
What did you learn about the world this time?
I learned about the world of fast fashion. So really? The documentary I watched dropped on HBO this week or last week, and it's called Brandy Helville and the Cult of Fast Fashion. Again, I knew absolutely nothing about this. I watched a trailer and went, that looks like it could be interesting. And I watched it and I learned a lot. Again, I knew nothing. So apparently, again, as a almost 50-year-old white male who doesn't have any children, there is a clothing store, line of clothing called Brandy Melville that has been around for about 15 years. And it caters to younger women or girls really in their like mid-teens to very early 20s. And it basically grew into this empire through social media. They spend no money on marketing or advertising. They don't have a giant board of directors with a teams of this, that, and the other thing. They really just put their brand out there. They got a certain type of girl to wear the products, and then they follow different people on social media. When they saw that, oh, you're a 14-year-old girl that has 100,000 followers, they would reach out to her and say, we're going to give you some free clothes if we can take your pictures and put them on our website of you and your friends wearing our clothes. And it blew up. It became this like mega corporation. They make hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And, you know, on its face, you think, wow, that's a great success story. But this whole documentary gets into the idea of the craziness that was going on behind the scenes, and the fact that the guy who runs the company is like a racist, a bigot, anti-Semite. You know, his people were sexually assaulting employees at their company, and they were basically taking advantage of young, naive women, you know, by promising fame and by promising, you know, internet status, by putting them on their website. And it was just all this crazy stuff going on. And the idea of fast fashion that the American specifically, but obviously a little more worldwide, how there's this idea of disposable clothing, like people will wear something a couple of times and then get rid of it, even though it's perfectly fine. But because fashion dictates that you know, this is no longer in style, or that you can't wear something again and again and again because that's not trendy, that, you know, that won't make you popular, people just ditch this clothing. And so part of the documentary talks about like what happens to all of those clothes. And while a lot of people think they're doing the right thing by donating these clothes to you know, those clothes boxes or churches or secondhand stores, there's way too much stuff being donated for it to be actually resold or used. And it gets shipped overseas to very poor countries. And it's like a pollution epidemic where these things are just dumped by the literal freighter load in these very poor countries, mainly in Africa, where they have to deal with all of this secondhand clothes that they then try and figure out a way to, you know, do something useful. And instead it just ends up going on their beaches and into their water. And it's just crazy. So it was sort of these sort of like two halves of this documentary. The first part is all about the Brandy Melville brand and how they rose to power using social media in a way that other companies never thought to do it. Then you get the second half about all the horrors of the fashion industry. So that was fascinating. Again, not something I know anything about. So this was completely new to me. I wasn't going in with any preconceptions whatsoever. It was extremely educational. It runs about an hour and a half, and I felt that was probably just about long enough. Sometimes these documentaries, they take a left turn, and then suddenly you get 25 minutes at the end about something that you don't know, that doesn't seem relevant. This one was good. It was the majority, more than the first hour, is all about the clothing line and the social media and all that stuff. And then it's sort of the last 20, 25 minutes that they start going down the idea of the fast fashion and what that means and the negativity around that. So anyway, it's called Brandy Melville and the Cult of Fast Fashion. And that was it for me this week. How about you, Chris? What are you watching?
It's actually been a bit of a banner week for me, Derek, at least in regard to me receiving items in the mail. So as you know, my friend, I'm a little old school. You know, it's true. So I know everything is pretty much available digitally, but I am still a DVD guy. Mm-hmm. And one of the main reasons why I'm not still a VHS guy is you just can't buy VCRs anymore. You know?
True.
Otherwise, I'd still be watching VHS. But, you know, I've mentioned before, I go up to the trailer on weekends and I don't have internet up there, so I watch DVDs. So I still have to buy DVDs. So this week, three DVDs came in the mail. To the surprise of no one, they're all old comedies from the 80s and kind of obscure ones too. So the first one, The Man with Two Brains.
That's Steve Martin, right?
Steve Martin, Carl Reiner directed it, Kathleen Turner's in it. I mentioned it on a recent podcast, so I had to go buy it. So I got that one. Next one I got was Amazon Women on the Moon.
I just watched that for the very first time, like a couple months ago.
Really? Because I'd mentioned it to you before.
Oh, no. I'm thinking Kentucky Fried Movie. I'm sorry.
Yes. Now, this one was like a spoof of late night TV with these commercial parodies and B-movie spoofs and all this kind of stuff. I'll have to get you to watch it someday. It's a very obscure 80s movie, but it's fantastic. And then another one. Remember Gary Marshall? Back in the day, he, you know, produced Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley and stuff.
Yep.
Well, then he decided finally, I'm going to go in and do feature films. So before he found success with Pretty Woman, he came out with this parody of soap operas called Young Doctors in Love. It is one of my favorite comedy movies from the 80s.
You've mentioned it before. Yeah, I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
Oh, my God. It's so good. So Michael McKean's in it, and Sean Young, and Dabney Coleman, Saul Rubinek, and also a very, very young Michael Richards. Kramer from Seinfeld is in it. So needless to say, here's to a fun summer at the trailer. For me, at least.
Yeah, I was going to say, I imagine your wife is going to like roll her eyes so far back in her head she's going to pass out when she has to
sit. My family will hate every minute of it, I'm sure. But I mean, that's what I do. I torture my family. And one of the ways I torture them is like this.
Here's your dad joke of the week.
Derek, I was thinking, you know, we're reviewing Night Shift this week, so I should do maybe I'd do a morgue joke for everyone.
Okay, I'm sure this will be an extremely bad taste, but I'll give you the benefit of the doubt.
Okay, Derek, why aren't morgues round?
I have no idea.
Because then there'd be no coroners.
Ooh, we need some dead air after that joke.
Ishtar.
This movie was so bad.
Most people hate this movie.
Maybe looking at it with today's lens.
I personally like this movie.
It was terrible.
Lip smacking, back snapping, perfectly delicious.
Just awful. I can't think of anything good to say about it.
I like what I like. You know, I make no apologies about it.
Turnabout is fair play.
I've literally watched 10 seasons of Bob Ross, The Joy of Painting.
It is fantastic.
At least we didn't lead lives of quiet desperation. Derek, this week it was over to me. I wanted us to go back to 1982 to watch Night Shift. So I made you watch it. What are your first impressions after seeing this movie again? Had it been a long time since you'd seen it?
Yeah, let me tell you a little bit about my relationship with this movie. Okay. So yeah. I watched it on one of the retro channels. It was on like maybe 6 months ago. And I remember I watched it. And when I talked about it on the podcast, you said, hey, I watched it this week as well. Which is why when you recommended this at the end of the last show, I said, didn't we already review this? But no, it was just that we happened to both coincidentally watch it in the same week. So I watched it recently, like within the last year. Prior to that, I hadn't seen this movie since probably the mid to late 80s, which was the one and only time before that I had seen this. And I was probably only like between 10 and 13 years old when I saw this the first time. And it didn't really make an impression on me either way. It was, in my mind, it was just jammed in there with a bunch of other 80s comedies. It had a couple of people. You're like, oh yeah, I think that person was in that movie. And then there was, of course, a couple of shots of shameless boobs, which is sort of an 80s requirement. But I didn't really have any real deep memories of this, good or bad. So coming to it this week, honestly, I was having a little trouble finding the movie. I knew it was available. You could buy it or rent it. But I thought, I'd really like to try and find it for free. And I almost decided I'm not paying for this movie. I've seen it recently enough. I can just talk about it. And I thought, no, I better do the right thing. And then I actually found it on YouTube for free and watched it again. And I'm glad I did, because even though I just watched this in the last year, I did not remember so much of this movie, which, again, I don't know if that's good or bad that after a year I've already forgotten the whole thing. But it was fine. I mean, I wasn't watching this in the edge of my seat going, this is the funniest, greatest, hilarious, best 80s comedy I've ever watched. There were definitely some things in there to like, but overall, I just kind of thought it was dull. And maybe that's just because I feel it's sort of dulled with age and the way that movies progressed since 82. But we could talk about it. There definitely were some high points, but I just found that a lot of it in my mind was sort of, you know, usually have peaks and valleys where you have these hilarious in comedies, you have these hilarious sequences, and then you need a little time to catch your breath. I found that it didn't, in my mind, it didn't really have those super highs, but it also didn't then have or need those really lows. So it was just, to me, it was sort of a straight line, kind of flat all the way through.
That's okay. You can be wrong. It's all right. Because like, for me, I don't think it's just a comedy. It's also kind of got some dramatic elements into it.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think it's also a bit of a commentary in a lot of ways. So I think it's a lot of good things. My relationship with this film is maybe a little bit different. I saw this movie in the theater when it first came out. Wow. Derek, I was 12 years old. So this is how much the world has changed, my friend. Just think about it. A 12-year-old going to the theater to see a movie about two guys running a prostitution ring out of the morgue at night. Like, and the thing was, I remember my grandma being at our house, and I was getting ready to go out to see the movie with my friend. Now, my grandma was very religious and very much a prude. And I remember she says to me, "What movie are you going to see?" And I'm like, "Oh, it's this movie called Night Shift." And she's like, "Well, what's the movie all about?" And then I start to say something and my mom cuts in. Because she's like, it's with Henry Winkler. And my grandma's like, "Oh, I like Fonzie. He's a good young man. That'll be a good movie for you to go see." Dodged a bullet that day, let me tell
no
you.
No kidding.
Not just me, but my mom too, really. So I going into this now, I assumed that this movie would age really, really badly. But I liked it. I thought it held up really, really well. And
yeah, I don't think it aged bad, just to be clear. No. We've watched some movies where you watch them now and you're like, mm-hmm. Oh my God, I can't believe in today's day and age this movie is even available. I don't think there's any of that. This is one that I actually think through today's lens works very well. Like, there's not a lot in here. There are a handful of small things, but there's not a lot of glaringly, blatantly obvious things where you just like cringe worthy. Like, you watch Revenge of the Nerds now and you think, oh, that movie's hilarious. And you start watching and you're like, oh my God, how did we find these things funny? Right. I really didn't feel there was any of that here that I can think of. I mean, there's a few things that maybe brush up against that, but nothing that's unforgivable. So from that sense, I think that it definitely held up well, and we can talk about some of the more specific things. And I definitely think that is to the movie's credit, because I think if it had more of those cringy kind of things, it would not have held up nearly as well as it did. I think the stars of this movie are a big reason why it does hold up. I think they all did great jobs, and we can talk more about their specific contributions as we go.
So the movie was directed by Ron Howard. It was written by Lowell Gans and Babalu Mandel. They were a writing duo. This was their first feature they did, but they went on to write a bunch of successful movies too. They did Splash, Spies Like Us, City Slickers, League of Their Own. So this one was made on a budget of $8.1 million. It grossed $21.1 million. At the domestic U.S. box office, so it was a success. But it finished low. It finished in 40th place that year, just below Neighbors and just above My Favorite Year.
Well, My Favorite Year was pretty good.
Oh, it was good, but it wasn't a huge, you know, commercial success, unfortunately. But the number one movie at the box office in 1982, you want to take a guess?
Sorry, what year? 1982?
1982.
What year was Empire Strikes Back?
1980.
Okay. Or, sorry, Jedi was
83.
So 82 was one of the Rocky movies, maybe?
No, the number one movie at the box office were like way ahead of everybody else. And it was E.T., the Extraterrestrial.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Funny enough, Raiders of the Lost Ark was the second highest grossing movie that year, even though it came out the year before. It was still making money.
Well, I remember 80s. It was re-released back into theaters the next year.
Yeah. And you made a good point with Rocky, because Rocky III was the third highest grossing film. Rounding out the top five was On Golden Pond at number four and An Officer and a Gentleman at number five. Porky's just missed the cut at number six. But then it was followed by Arthur, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan in eight, Poltergeist 9, and Best Little Whorehouse in Texas was 10. So not a bad year for movie. But I want to talk about the director, Ron Howard, because, you know, the guy was like Hollywood royalty in some ways, because his dad was Rance Howard, who he wasn't a big star, but he appeared in, you know, all kinds of roles in television and film. Might recognize him best from Splash. I don't know if you remember. He was the customer that was mad at Tom Hanks for the Rotten Cherries.
I remember we talked about it when we reviewed Splash, but no, I couldn't pick him out of the lineup if you paid me.
So Ron Howard's mom, Jean Spiegel Howard, she was an actress as well, but she pretty much just gave it up to raise the family. And then Ron was obviously a child actor. He was Opie Taylor on The Andy Griffith Show. Right. He went on, he was in American Graffiti and Happy Days. And then he just decided to move behind the camera as director. So his first feature film was 1977's Grand Theft Auto, which he also starred in. And that was a Russ Meyer, you know, produced film. So it wasn't very good. And then he directed a couple of made-for-TV movies, and then he came out with this, Night Shift, in 82. And then after this, he went on a real tear for a while. He did Splash and Cocoon, Willow, Apollo 13. And then he won an Oscar for directing A Beautiful Mind in 2001. He's had more, I would say, mixed results in recent years, at least in my opinion.
Like that's fair. Yeah.
The Da Vinci Code, I thought, sucked. I thought Solo sucked, too. That's just me. But what do you think of Ron Howard as a director?
Like you said, he's had a success. I mean, I liked Apollo 13, and Beautiful Mind was fine. I mean, but no, in my mind, it's like the upper echelon of directors usually end up creating their own style. They bring something to the movie that another director just couldn't do, whether it's the way they shoot it, the way they interact with it. Like, again, not being a director, I can't speak to the specifics of it, but like when you see a Tarantino movie, even if you didn't tell me this is a Quentin Tarantino movie, I would know. If you see a Scorsese film, 9 times out of 10, you're going to go, this is clearly Scorsese. And even, you know, less famous, less popular directors, a lot of them will develop a style. We reviewed the movie Snatch a couple of weeks back. Mm-hmm. Guy Ritchie has a very distinct style as well. Or even someone like, the guy who directed Armageddon, his name's escaping me right now, Michael Bay. Again, got a very, you know, he's made a lot of money, his own style. With Ron Howard, nothing in my mind stands out to the point where I could watch a movie, I go, oh, that's clearly a Ron Howard movie. Which is not to say that he doesn't do a good job. I just don't think that he's got a style that separates him from the pack in a way that would say, oh, he's got a style and that separates him in a good way. So that's just my opinion.
I was listing off some of his movies. One that I missed was Gung Ho from 85. It wasn't a huge hit, but I liked that movie. It was pretty good.
Never saw it.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the cast. Let's get into him. Henry Winkler, my idol. I really liked how he played against type here. But the thing was, it still wasn't enough to break him from being typecast as Fonzie. He basically went 25 years there where he just could not get work. Yeah. Even though the guy's clearly capable of playing characters outside of Fonzie, you know? And in 1979, he was in this made-for-TV movie called An American Christmas Carol. It was shot up here in Ontario, in Elora, in fact. And that they put in like these local Canadian actors like R.H. Thompson was in it and stuff. And then he did Night Shift, and he's so opposite from Fonzie. But like, and the thing was, not once, and I love Henry Winkler, as you know, but not once was I watching this movie and thinking, hey, that's Fonzie.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Not once. Like, he was just perfect as this sort of meek, wimpy pushover. You know, I think he's a really great actor, because in Barry too, he's the opposite. You know, he's this egotistical, untalented creep.
Yeah.
You know? But you know, the thing is, in Barry, his character takes a real journey and has a definite character arc. I mean, I think he's the real deal. You know, Henry Winkler's a good actor. I think he's good. I'm not just saying that because he's my idol. You know, I'm obviously biased.
And he and Adam Sandler became friends in the 90s because Adam Sandler was a big fan of his work. And so he had cast him in some of his movies.
He did The Waterboy. And that was one of his first kind of comeback things. Like, oh, I forgot all about this guy, you know?
Yeah. And then he appeared in a number of Adam Sandler movies after that. And I know there was one. I remember him talking about Henry Winkler. That is, I remember him talking about it. And I can't remember the name of the movie, but Adam Sandler made this movie right after his father died. And in this movie, there's a scene where the character's father died and he wanted Henry Winkler to play the father. And by that point, the two of them had become friends. And so I remember Henry Winkler saying that he felt, you know, very emotional and very, you know, honored that he would be able to portray Adam Sandler's father in this movie. And so, again, it's one of these examples where a lot of Hollywood people will tend to work with a lot of their friends and people over and over again. And I think that relationship between Adam Sandler and Henry Winkler helped Henry Winkler's career sort of get back on track, you know, all those years later. Because by then he's an older guy, he's a little overweight. Like, he's not Fonzie anymore. So it was an opportunity for him to reach a new audience who maybe wasn't familiar with his work and give him a chance to become an older actor. So,
As you know, Derek, my wife got me a one-on-one session to meet him virtually for my Christmas gift a couple of years ago. And the thing is, like, they always say you shouldn't meet your heroes, you know, and I guess in case they don't turn out to be the people you thought they were. Mm-hmm. Not the case with Henry Winkler. He is the nicest celebrity of all time. Like, just a truly kind human being. He just appreciates everything. I remember I told him when I met him, and I said, you know, this is my Christmas gift for my wife, because it allowed me the opportunity to tell him what he's meant to me over the years, like how much I've admired him and how much I've looked up to him as a role model. And his response to me was, no, this is a gift to me. I love Henry Winkler. I love that guy. He's so good, man. Okay, so Michael Keaton was also in this. Man, he was so good.
He was really good. For a debut performance.
What a debut.
Yeah, oh, no, this one's pretty good.
Such a standout performance. He's got this hyperkinetic energy. He's all over the place. But yet, underneath it, he's this super vulnerable guy. And then, and what a name, Bill Blazejowski. Billy Blaze. It's so good. So Michael Keaton got started in TV. Actually, back in 1974, he did an episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. He was the black and white panda. Huh. And then he did two more episodes of Mr. Rogers in 1975. And he did a bunch of guest appearances on some TV shows in the 70s. And then he got a starring role on a short-lived sitcom with Jim Belushi called Working Stiffs. It only lasted 9 episodes and got canceled. That was in 1979. And it's funny because, you know, if you think about it, this movie, Night Shift, fine title. A good title for this movie would have been Working Stiffs.
Yeah, think about kidding.
Because really, the two guys are, the main characters, are working stiffs. They're just two guys just doing a job, right? And then, of course, you've got the stiffs, you know, with the dead bodies. And then, you know, the whole prostitutes would be working stiffs.
Oh my.
George gets it. Anyway, I thought, you know, this movie was great as a breakout role. Like we said, he just chews up the scenery. And even though his character is basically obnoxious, he kind of comes off as like charismatic. I thought that he really nailed it.
Lovable is sort of
it. Yeah. You know, and he went on a real run for a while there. He did like Mr. Mom and Gung Ho, like I mentioned. Johnny Dangerously and Beetlejuice, and then, of course, Batman. And then his career just kind of stalled, you know? He had critical success with Birdman and Dope Sick, which you made me watch. I thought it was good. But they weren't really, like, huge with mainstream audiences. His career is kind of stalled, right?
Yeah, in the 90s, again, because I was working at Blockbuster Video, he did a bunch of movies, and as they came in, you're like, oh, hey, here's one with Michael Keaton, and you watch it, and you're like, and that was just okay. Like one of the ones that he did that I can't find anywhere was called Multiplicity, where he was able to make a clone of himself so that he could, you know, send the clone off to do his day job and he could goof around at home. And
wasn't it like then, Gina Davis with him?
I think it was Annie McDowell.
Oh, maybe it was. Yes.
And right. So, I mean, that one had some funny bits in it, but like it is not a memorable Michael Keaton movie. I only remember because it was a popular renter when it came out of Blockbuster. But, you know, so those are the kinds of movies that he was doing in the 90s. And it's like, yeah, exactly. It almost seemed like at that point after he did Batman, it's like, let's just cash in some paychecks. Like I'd like to think at that point in his life, maybe he had settled down a little bit. Maybe he had a family. He was raising his kids. Like, I don't know, but that sounds about right. Like, I figure Batman was probably where he made his most money, like when he was making the Batman sequel. And then after that, I imagine he was just like, I'm just going to be a dad for a while. I'm going to chillax, take a few paychecks, do some easy work, and go from there. But it's nice to see that he's bounced back. Because, I mean, he was in one of the more recent Spider-Man films with Tom Holland, and he was great in that as well. So. Yeah, he's really sort of coming back into it. And he's doing the new Beetlejuice movie, which is already getting fantastic buzz. Apparently the trailer just was released and everyone's going on and on about how great this movie's going to be next year. So he's still around.
And going back to the Batman in 89, like it was controversial. A lot of people did not like the fact that he was cast in that, you know, because he was this goofy kind of, you know, comedic actor. But I thought he was really good. I thought he was good in that.
No, I did. Again, especially looking back, I think he's been given a lot more credit now than he was then for doing a good job.
So I want to mention Shelley Long in this. I thought she looked fantastic here.
Yeah,
so
I agree.
There's obviously a lot of scenes where she's got the makeup piled on. I mean, you know, she's playing a prostitute, so I get it. Mm-hmm. But the scene where she's cooking him the scrambled eggs in the morning, no makeup, just a shirt. She looks really, really good. And I think most people just think of her as Diane Chambers on Cheers, where she was this uptight, snooty character. But man, she was actually quite a beautiful woman. And I liked some of her early 80s stuff. She was in Caveman. And she did this movie called Losing It. I remember going to see that in the movie theater. It's Tom Cruise and Jackie Earle Haley were in it. It was pretty good. And obviously she rather famously left Cheers to pursue a Hollywood movie career. And it never really panned out.
Well, come on. I mean, Troop Beverly Hills.
Although I did think she was pretty good in the Brady Bunch movie. I'll give her credit for that. I thought she was good in that.
Sure.
But yeah, her movie career just never kind of didn't really take off. But yeah, you liked her in this movie, I'm assuming?
I thought she did a good job. Honestly, my sort of first experience with her was as Diane Chamber on Cheers, mm-hmm. and I never liked her character,
most people did, and that was the whole
given
point.
Given that I was younger, I found it was hard for me to separate the fact that because I don't like this character, that transferred to then I don't like this performer. And so I was never really a fan of her stuff. And then honestly, she didn't make any fantastic films when she left the show. So I sort of felt that my opinion was justified, as I'm sure a lot of other people did, rightly or wrongly. So looking back on this, again, you want to sort of give her the benefit of the doubt. I think she did a great job. And yeah, I never really thought of her as a very attractive woman. She's just not really my type, never did it for me. But that scene where she's in the kitchen making the breakfast and you see her underwear, I'm like, she looked pretty hot there.
That's what I thought too. Another person I do want to mention is Clint Howard. So it's Ron Howard's brother. And Ron Howard puts him in almost all of his movies.
Just about, yeah.
He is just such a unique looking person. And you know, he's worked like crazy, but I think he probably would have struggled to get parts if it wasn't for his brother, you know, because I think casting directors just wouldn't know what to do with this guy. But if you look at his IMDb, he has done a ton of stuff. But really, as I go down the list, the only things that really sort of stick out are the movies directed by Ron, you know, and he's only really in the one scene, A Night Shift. And it's, of course, the one scene with nudity, too, when he's at the frat party and he's in the drawer. With the prostitute. I mean, it was an 80s movie, you know.
Wasn't he also the first time we see Michael Keaton going out to drive the limo? Wasn't he the guy that he's like, that was there to get
he was
up?
In the back seat. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. There was that. So, yeah. So he just kind of stood out to me. So I want to talk a little bit about this film in terms of the theme of this movie.
Okay.
And you always can help me answer this question. Could they make this movie today?
Absolutely.
Yeah, a movie about two night workers at the morgue running a prostitution ring.
I think it can go one of two ways. You either do it as a more realistic portrayal, where I think there'd be a lot less deliberate comedy, and it would be more a commentary on, you know, how people working certain jobs don't have opportunities, have to make their own opportunities, even if they're, you know, the wrong side of legal. And then you get into the whole moral dilemmas of the prostitutes and all the rest of that. And how do they launder their money? Like there's definitely one angle you can do and set it up that way. But I think probably the better way to do it would be to follow in the footsteps of this one, make it more comedic, make it a little goofy. And I found that this one, this movie from 1982, while I think you're right, I think it's more of a drama with some funny parts. I think that if you were to remake this today, in order for audiences to actually accept the premise as a comedy, you would have to make it kind of over the top goofy. You would need characters more like Kramer from Seinfeld that are just like wacky and zany. Like I think, you know, if you recast these roles and kept these characters, whoever comes in as the Michael Keaton role has to just be over the top to the point where it's bordering on annoying much more than Michael Keaton does in this one. But again, they never come to me and ask me what I think. We've had lots of podcasts where we've talked about how we would remake movies or make sequels, but those are just a couple of ideas I would have off the top of my head.
As I watched this movie, I realized there was a couple of scenes in it that really stood out to me as, you know, some of my favorite scenes. One that I really liked was when Bill Blazdowski is first addressing the prostitutes. And he writes the word prostitution on the chalkboard.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, let's break down this word. What are we talking about here? Pro. Well, we know what that is, you know. And then, well, I think we all know what that means. Two. And then shun, of course, from the Latin to shun, to say, no, thanks anyway, I don't want it, push it away. That doesn't even belong in this word. I just felt like the whole thing was improvised, and I thought it was pretty funny. So another one that really stood out to me was when he uses the, it made me laugh so much, when he uses the Kleenex for his muscles.
Right.
And he
right,
puts them in yeah. his pants because he's like putting them in his biceps. And then all of a sudden he like kind of looks at the Kleenex and he looks down and he just stuffs them into his pants to like to make his bulge look bigger. And I like how he kind of pushes his hips out. And moves it. I don't know why it made me laugh so much.
Well, and then later in the movie when I can't remember the specific context, but he's like, oh, hey, you know, where's so-and-so? He's like, oh, did someone rough her up? And then he grabs the Kleenex.
Where's my muscles?
Jamming it in his thing. And Henry Winkler's like, no, leave the muscles behind.
Exactly. That was so funny. And another scene that I really liked was when Vincent Schiavelli is delivering his food. And he's like, where the f*** is 4K? And Henry Winkler's like, what? He's like, oh, sorry. I didn't know you were deaf. 4K! Just the way he delivers that line, I thought it was so funny. Henry Winkler didn't want the mustard on his yeah. sandwich, so Schiavelli just wipes the mustard on the door. I thought that was pretty funny. Yeah.
Like, one of the things that I actually really liked about this was the fact that Henry Winkler's character isn't immediately on board. And he's like, no, we're not going to do this. And then when he reluctantly agrees, even while he's doing it, his character is struggling with it. He talks mm-hmm. about having stress and he's, you right. know, his stomach hurts and his hair's falling out.
His hair's falling out.
And, yeah. and I like that it wasn't just a complete, you know, you flip a switch and suddenly he went from, no, I don't want to do this to, yeah, I'm all in we're good. It was, yeah, even though he was all in and they were doing it, he was still clearly wrestling with the ethical quandrums. You know, he thought he knew what he wanted. He thought he knew who he was. And he was really, really struggling. And I think that that's a failure that a lot of newer movies make, where you give a character, you put a character in a situation where they have to really make a hard choice. And in the case when they are forced to make the choice that's against what their gut is telling them, they just immediately are like, good with it. Okay, well, now that we've decided to do this, I'm all in. I'm fine with it. And it's like, you know what? This to me in this film was what I believe a more realistic portrayal. I think someone in this situation would continue to struggle. Yeah, you're making all this money and yeah, you're around pretty women and there's a lot of upsides to it, but he's clearly still struggling with it because this is a very sharp left turn from the way he normally behaves and acts. So that's one of the things I think this movie did really, really well was, you know, it had the character, Henry Winkler's character, stay sort of true to who he was, even when he was doing things that were clearly out of his comfort zone and out of character. And then by the time at the end, when it's like, you know, he becomes a more of a man, quote, manly man, that makes sense given the journey he's had through the film. It was, and again, it didn't feel like all of a sudden it was this forced ending where you're like, oh, of course this is happening. I mean, yeah, you could predict it was going to happen, but it made sense. It was character development that was clearly being developed through the course of the story. So I thought that was really good.
But yeah, making that point about, you know, more of a dramatic kind of aspect of the film, like you're talking about with Henry Winkler's character, I like the way that they handled the women versus the men aspects of this. Like when Chuck is upset because Belinda's not going to quit being a prostitute. And I loved how she threw it back at him because he's like, I can't get over the fact that you didn't quit after they had sex, right?
Yeah.
And she's like, I didn't quit. Did you quit? And he's like, I'm not a whore. She's like, no, you're a pimp. And I thought that was interesting, you know, to kind of put him in his place.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just about, you know, the women being prostitutes. It was the fact that the men were involved in this too. And therefore they were in just as deep. Whether they, you can call it whatever you want, but you're still one of them, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I thought that was an interesting way to handle it. So,
yep.
One of my favorite recurring bits of the whole film was Bill Blazkowski's entrepreneurial ideas.
Yes. I got to think that many of those were improv.
Oh, they had to be. And he's like this idea man. And he's like, I just get ideas all day. I can't control them. They're like, I'm just fighting them off. Jeez. And then he's like, wait, I got an idea to eliminate garbage. Edible paper. You eat it, it's gone. out of there. No garbage. Like, what the hell? And then when he's talking about the tuna fish, where you have to mix the mayonnaise, and he's like, wait a minute, what if you mix the mayonnaise in the can? And then, wait a minute, I got an idea. You take live tuna fish and you feed them the mayonnaise. Oh my God. And then he grabs his tape recorder. He's like, call Starkist.
Yeah.
Like, there were so many funny moments of that. And then, of course, I like when he says, my mission in life is make Chuck a man. That was like his biggest entrepreneurial thing, which really kind of drove the film. So
yeah,
thought that was good. There was one other thing I wanted to mention that, in terms of scenes that stood out to me. There's this, the way it's shot in frame, when anyone comes walking to or away from the door to Chuck's office, I don't know if you notice this, but when they come toward the door, their shadow gets smaller. And when they're walking away from the door, their shadow gets bigger because it's shot, it's backlit. I thought it was a neat effect the way it was framed in the scene. You know what I mean? Or is that just me?
No, I think that was a deliberate, obviously it was a deliberate choice. No, and I did notice that during, it was interesting. Yeah. Small detail, but sometimes the small details make the difference.
Exactly. So I also thought, as many, you know, 80s films have, good quotes. Any quotes stand out to you? So obviously the one that stood out to me the most when I watched is Love Brokers, which I thought was pretty cool. There was a whole bunch of other quotes. So near the beginning, I thought it was funny when he's with his girlfriend and then they hear the country music and then he goes over there and then the girl is like, is he going to turn down that awful music? And she's like, what does he mean awful? Awful good. Because he sees how big he is, which I thought was pretty funny. And then at one point, Henry Winkler's like, as we're sitting here, there's women, female human beings rolling around in strange beds with strange men, and we're making money from that. And Bill Blazioski's like, is this a great country or what?
Yeah.
I thought, oh my God, there's that American dream thing. I also liked, there was a guy, Leonard, I think his name was. He was like that kind of goofy nephew of the owner of the thing. He's like, oh, that Barney Rubble. What an actor. I don't know why that made me laugh, this cartoon character. And then when Leonard leaves, Henry Winkler takes over and he's like looking at all of his paperwork. And he's like, looking at these forms. He's like, name of the deceased, something Polish.
Yeah,
I thought that was pretty funny. And then Chuck opens up the morgue drawer and Blazioski like finally realizes where they are. And he looks at, he's like, that guy's dead. Mm-hmm. Like it kind of dawns on him.
When Michael Keaton first comes in and he's talking to Henry Winkler and he picks up a picture of his wife and he goes, oh, who's this? He goes, that's my fiance. And the nicest thing he can say about the picture is, nice frame.
Oh, right.
And he puts it down. Like,
that's right.
It's subtle, right? Like, it's like he doesn't say anything about the woman in the picture. Right. All he can say is, nice frame.
And that was Gina Hecht. I remember she used to do like little bit parts back in the 70s. She was in that show, Making It. They made a show. Remember that song, Making It? Making it. I'm making it. No,
yeah, the guy don't know it.
No. Anyway, it was like a really popular song. So they actually made a TV show.
I can see why.
And she was in it. But what else? Oh, when Henry Winkler is like, his wife is so neurotic. And he's like, why do you listen to my mother? This is the same woman who goes to a seance every night since my father died, just so she can still yell at him. And then when they're in jail, another one that stood out to me was when Chuck is like spitting on himself. Remember, he's like, I don't deserve to. And Bill's like, come on, man, this looks bad. He's like, what, who cares? Well, I'm not running for cell president. And he's like, no, you know, they have that.
Yeah.
It made me laugh. It just caught me off guard.
But one of the lines that I remember, again, it's a subtle thing, is when Henry Winkler's trying, like early in the movie, when he's going to have sex with the wife and she's in the bedroom or in the bathroom. And she's like, oh, I'm trying to lose 15 pounds. And he's like, why don't you run to the bed and maybe you'll lose a few pounds that way. I just found that really funny.
Yeah, that was good. But like, yeah, we mentioned all these like funny quotes and stuff, but it's not just a comedy, right? Like it has a lot of dramatic elements. For me, it's about things like redemptions, but really at its core, I feel like this movie is just about friendship.
Yeah, definitely. That's a big part of it for sure.
And probably like why the song they play at the end of the movie is that's what friends are for.
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. So through the course of the movie, the score is a lot of the score is variations of that. That's what friends is for song. So I'm hearing it in the course of the movie and I'm going, like I'm humming along going, well, I know this. What is this? And it takes me a minute. And then I'm like, oh, I know that song. It's Dionne Warwick. That's what friends are for. And then I start thinking, that song was from like 85, 86, 87. Like this movie's from 82. I'm like, I didn't realize that they re-released it. And then at the end of the movie, when the credits roll, you hear the lyrics to the song. It's being sung by Rod Stewart.
Rod Stewart was singing it.
And I was like, what? So I literally had to look it up. And it's like, yeah, it was written for the movie. Burt Bacharach wrote the song. He wrote all the songs. And Rod Stewart sang the lyrics. And it wasn't a very big hit. I don't think it was a hit at all. And then Dionne Warwick and friends re-recorded it and re-released it later in the 80s. And it was a huge hit. And they donated all the money to charity. I was like, oh.
It was for AIDS research.
Yes, that was it. I knew it was for a charitable cause. I couldn't remember specifically.
Then that song really took off. But yeah, you're right. Burt Bacharach wrote that song. He wrote all the songs. And he did the soundtrack and the score. A lot of the score, you're right, was variations of that song. But it was like that 80s kind of, I don't know, almost like techno kind of sound to it. But
that's, I mean, not the techno part, but that's typical of movies where you have a theme song. Yeah. And then through the course of the movie, you get instrumental versions and variations of the theme song through the course of the movie to match the mood, you know, faster,
like
slower,
Titanic or
whatever.
Or something
exactly.
Like that.
Exactly. You know, and good example. Well, I mean, yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, that's a typical movie trope. So I certainly don't fault it for that. But when it's a song that's a big song that you're familiar with, it can almost be a little distracting. So,
you know, I thought Burt Bacharach's songs in this movie were good. There was a couple that stood out, like even like that Girls Know How. Like it stood out. There was a montage sequence and they were doing, you know, do-do-do-do-do-do. Don't the girls know how to do-do-do. Like, I don't know. I thought it was all really well. It's like they brought in somebody really talented, obviously, to do the score and stuff. So it was good.
Yeah.
So this movie actually received a nomination for the Golden Globe Award for Best Actor. Henry Winkler was nominated that
year. Good for him.
Yeah, he was nominated up against Robert Preston for Victor Victoria, Al Pacino for Arthur, Peter O'Toole in My Favorite Year.
My favorite year.
But they all lost to Dustin Hoffman in Tootsie.
That's fair.
So, yeah, fair. I don't know if you knew that. I did not know this until I started doing some research for this. This movie was so popular, it actually led to a television series.
Oh, I read that in the notes. Yeah, no, I had no idea about that until I looked it up this week.
1984 to 1985, starring Scott Bakula and Jim Belushi.
Didn't even
know that.
No, like, I had no idea.
Crazy, you know? And again, Jim Belushi going back to 1979 when he starred with Michael Keaton in Working Stiffs, you know, just a little bit of a full circle thing there. But so I think we're kind of wrapping things up now with the film. Anything else you want to mention on it, or do you want to give it a rating out of 10?
I'd probably give it like a 6.5. It was fine. I don't need to revisit it again anytime soon. But, you know, if you haven't seen it, I think it's worth watching if you can find it. And it's available for free on YouTube. So there's no reason to avoid it. If you're looking for something to watch, 2 hours. Why not?
I think I would bump it up a bit higher. I might go 7.5 out of 10 because I have a bit of a nostalgic factor with
fair.
This movie.
And the Henry Winkler of it all.
And Henry Winkler, like I just, you know, love him so much. But I thought it was actually quite good. Like I thought it was quite, for an 80s comedy, you know, and again, on its surface, the subject matter is two guys are running a prostitution ring out of the morgue. What? And it's a comedy? Like, what? But it actually pulls it off. And I think in some ways, too, I feel like it set a bit of a standard for, like, kind of buddy-buddy comedies throughout the 80s. So I don't know. I thought it was quite good. So I'll give it that. What do you say now we have some?
Fun with Caveman.
All right, my man. It is over to you. So what do you want to do?
All right, we're going to go with the staple here. We're going to go with Pick the Flick.
Pick the Flick. Yeah, Pick the Flick. You get the synopsis, then Pick the Flick. You get the year, Pick the Flick.
All right, lay it on me. What do I got?
All right. So we've done a lot of Michael Keaton movies on this podcast. So we've actually done a couple of Michael Keaton trivia things. So that, you know, was completely out the window. So I look to the subject matter of this movie. So Shelley Long, who is, you know, one of the leads in this film, plays a prostitute. This movie's about prostitution. Well, I mean, a big part of this movie, prostitution is a big part of it. And, you know, people who are paying to have sex. And so I put together a list of some movies that feature prostitution. Either one of the main characters is a prostitute, or there's a significant part of the movie where there's a transactional part of it where people are paying to have sex. So that's your common theme. Prostitution is your common theme here. I got, I think there's about 10 or 12 movies here. There's some that are a little newer, and but most of them are 80s and 90s for the most part. I got the synopsis, the year, and I also have the stars of the film. So if you don't know it with the synopsis and the year, I will then give you further clues with the list of the main stars of the film.
Okay.
All right. First one is from 1980. A Los Angeles escort is accused of a murder, which they did not commit.
It's American Gigolo.
It is.
Yes.
And I actually changed the wording so that it didn't specifically say which he did not commit, because wanted to see if you were paying attention there. I've never seen it, but I've heard it's a great film. All right.
Pretty good.
1979, the year before.
Okay.
A religious businessman from Michigan has to venture into the world of pornography in California, desperately searching for his runaway teenage daughter.
That was with George C. Scott.
It was with George C. Scott. Yes.
Hardcore.
Yes. I'd never heard of this, but it was ranked very highly on the various websites when I was looking at the homework here. All right. 1993. Nice easy one for you. Okay. A billionaire offers $1 million to a young married couple for just one night with the wife.
Oh, wasn't that called Indecent Proposal?
Yes. Yes, it was. Robert Redford.
Robert Redford.
And, you know, I'm thinking an interesting remake of this would be if you have the same premise, but the guy offers the male partner, who is straight, $1 million to sleep with him. I think that's how you remake this movie today. Jeez. Anyway, okay. 1969, a little earlier than we usually go, but I think you'll get this. A naive hustler travels from Texas to New York City to seek personal fortune, finding a new friend in the process.
Oh, great film. It's Midnight Cowboy.
Yes, it is. All right. A little newer here, 2003. This movie is based on the real-life story of a Daytona Beach prostitute who became a serial killer.
Was it Monster?
It was Monster.
Yes, that I saw that. That was quite good. That was
5 for 5 here.
And because just recently I watched a documentary on that girl. I can't remember her name, her real name.
Well, and but it was Charlize Theron. I took her name out of it, so just in case you knew it. Yeah, Charlize Theron, Christina Ricci in that one. Yeah. All right, you're definitely going to get the next couple here. These are big films. 1971, a small-town detective searching for a missing man has only one lead, a connection with a New York prostitute.
Oh, is it Clute?
It is Clute.
Yes. Yeah,
I figured you'd get that one.
Because they actually make an allusion to that movie in Night Shift.
Yeah. The whole looking at the watch sequence,
Yep.
James All right.
Fonda, Donald Sutherland,
All right, next one, right in your wheelhouse, 1983.
Oh, I like
a
that.
Snobbish investor and a wily street con artist find their positions reversed as part of a bet by two callous millionaires.
Oh, that's Trading Places.
Yeah. And Jamie Lee Curtis.
Because Jamie Lee Curtis is in there. Yeah.
It's not really about prostitution. Right. She's definitely one of the main characters.
Yeah.
All right.
Very cool.
1990.
Just watched that the other week when I was on vacation.
Yeah, it was on TV not too long ago. I watched it again myself.
So good.
Okay, next one. 1990. A man in a legal but hurtful business needs an escort for some social events and hires a beautiful prostitute that he meets, only to fall in love.
In 1990? Oh, jeepers. I don't know.
Really? Okay, I'll give you the world's biggest hint. It stars Julia Roberts.
Oh, it's Pretty Woman.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Yeah, okay. I was amazed you didn't get that off the clue. But All right. This one's from 1986.
Okay.
A man recently released from prison manages to get a job driving a call girl from customer to customer.
86? I don't know.
It stars Bob Hoskins, Michael Caine, and Kathy Tyson.
That doesn't help me any.
Okay. It's called Mona Lisa. I'd never heard of it either.
Never heard of it.
Again, apparently it got a lot of critical press when it came out.
Yeah. How did I not get the Pretty Woman one?
Go figure. Yeah, I don't know. All right. This one's from...
Overthinking it, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. This one's from 1993.
Okay.
In Detroit, a pop culture nerd steals cocaine from his new wife's pimp and tries to sell it in Hollywood, prompting the mobsters who own the drugs to pursue the couple.
This is one you had me watch. I'd never seen it before. Is it True Romance?
It is True Romance. Yeah,
it was really good. Yeah, I remember how I liked that movie. Yeah.
All right. We just got a couple more here. 1983. 10 years earlier.
Okay.
A pimp on the run trusts his sex workers to a meek professor of literature who accepts the challenge.
Oh, Dr. Detroit.
Yep.
Yes.
Dr. Detroit.
That movie was good. I like that.
All right. A couple easy ones coming down the stretch here. 1995, a Hollywood screenwriter who lost everything because of his alcoholism arrives in Las Vegas to drink himself to death. While there, he meets and forms an uneasy friendship with and non-interference pact with a prostitute.
That's Leaving Las Vegas.
Okay, it's Nicolas Cage won the Oscar. All right, last one, 1983.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
A teenager is looking for fun at home while his parents are away, but the situation quickly gets out of hand.
Risky business,
baby. Risky business. Tom Cruise.
Yep. Nice. Oh, I did pretty good at that.
Yeah, you only missed
a couple. Go figure, I know a lot about prostitution in film.
Uh-huh. Go figure. Yeah. We won't read into that more than we need
to. Go figure. Okay, so I suggested the movie this week, so next movie is over to you. What have you got for us?
All right, this one's going to seem a little like an odd pick, given the kind of movies you and I usually watch.
Mm-hmm. That's okay.
And it's from 1998. It stars Gwyneth Paltrow. It's called Sliding Doors. Have you ever seen it?
No, I've heard of it, but I've never seen Sliding Doors. No.
Okay. I actually had a chance to watch it right at the beginning of the pandemic. So it's been a few years now, but you know, somewhat recently. And I remember at that time, it had been about a decade since I'd seen this movie. And I remember thinking, wow, this movie's way better than I remember it being.
That's not the one where she was singing with Huey Lewis, was it?
No, I think that one was called Duets. In any case,
shows you what I know.
Sliding Doors from 1998. I don't want to say too much about it now. Okay. We'll talk more about it next week. I encourage you to watch this one with your wife. I think she'll enjoy it as well.
Okay.
It's available for free on Tubi and on Plex for anyone who might be looking for it at no charge. But yeah, we'll take it away and we'll come back next week and watch Sliding Doors.
All right. Yeah, we'll watch Sliding Doors. We'll come back next week and we will review that film. But until then, I'm Chris McBrien. You're Derek Myers. And we're both saying thanks for taking the time to listen to Pop Goes Your World, the pop culture podcast for the generations.
Thanks for listening to Pop Goes Your World. You can contact Chris and Derek at popgoesyourworld.com. Please take a minute and review the podcast on iTunes or wherever you download and listen to the show.